From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Wednesday, two Rwandan journalists were sentenced to life imprisonment by a UN war crimes tribunal convened in neighboring Tanzania. Ferdinand Nahimana and Hassan Ngezi had been convicted of inciting genocide in the 1994 Rwandan bloodbath that killed 800,000 minority Tutsis. Nahimana's broadcasts targeted specific victims, and Ngezi's newspaper promulgated a Hutu Ten Commandments inciting murder of civilians. They were found to have used the media as a machete, the first such verdict since the 1946 Nuremberg trial of Nazi propagandist Julius Streicher. Stephen Rapp was a prosecutor in the Rwanda case, and he joins me now from Arusha, Tanzania. Stephen, welcome back to OTM.
Good to be on.
Tell me about this verdict. What is its significance?
Well, it was an absolutely groundbreaking verdict. It's really the first time that the media, and specifically the people who controlled it, were held responsible for their broadcasts as the crimes that constituted the genocide and direct and public incitement to genocide.
What was the defense?
The defense initially was, you know, that these were political organs that were stating their views. There was an invasion going on, and they were denouncing that enemy that was threatening what they viewed as democracy in the country, and that these things never really had any causal connection to any killings. Now, eventually, during the course of the case, we very solidly showed that there was a very direct causal connection, that the killers were directed to specific places of refuge, even to specific victims, specific cars where somebody was identified by a license number. And so they pulled back from that and basically took the position that at the time that the media became truly virulent, they were no longer in control of it. They had started it for benign purposes, and then later on it was taken over, and they had nothing to do with it. And the most challenging part of proving the case was showing their control. It's individuals that had to be held responsible, and that's what the judges found we were able to do.
To what extent did the defendants argue that the right of free expression entitled them to print whatever they wished?
We had that argument, particularly from Ngezi, who had an American consul and who made the public policy argument that even though the First Amendment didn't apply to this case, that we were really under international law, the court should reach out and apply a similar standard, and that not to do so would be to essentially invite dictators to suppress dissent. They were constantly saying that things like the Hutu Ten Commandments, saying that one should have no pity on the Tutsis, were nasty, but that's the kind of thing that you should permit as part of a fledgling democracy, and that really, since there was no direct connection to the violence, as they would say, there should be protected expression.
Did the court rule specifically on that argument before rendering its final verdict?
In a sense, yes. I mean, the court did spend a lot of time being very careful about the fact that certain types of expression and certain articles, et cetera, wild and vituperative and whatever, were protected. It's when you begin to talk about an enemy and you begin to talk about the destruction of that enemy, and you begin to define that in terms that are clearly understood to mean not a military opponent, but Tutsi civilians, that you cross the line. And so they found that the line had been crossed. The line internationally, they set it at a little different place than we would set it in America. They followed the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantees free expression in its famous Article 19. But in Article 20, it allows, indeed mandates, laws against the incitement of hatred, discrimination, and violence. And that's a legal kind of thing that's different than America, because we have no explicit constitutional provision that allows restriction on hate speech. But one is implied in our law, by our courts, that once you have a clear and present danger, an imminency of violence, that speech does cross that line.
It strikes me as an extension of Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous admonition that the right of free speech does not permit you to scream fire in a crowded theater. But as a legal precedent, does it create a slippery slope and invite the suppression of legitimate free expression whenever there is an environment of violence?
I'm always concerned about slippery slope arguments, because this is to say, in essence, that if you have a police, you're going to have a police state. All law is about the distinctions. And in the case of expression, the fundamental decision that's made in democracy is that the best solution is wide open expression. The best answer to bad speech is good speech. And that that is going to be the almost universal rule. But just as in America, where we've decided through our courts that there is a line that can be crossed, certainly to draw that line in the context of a genocidal or widespread and systematic attack on civilian population context, I think is not dangerous, and it is necessary at the end of the day, given what we demonstrated in Rwanda, that use of the media in support of a killing campaign really needs to be restricted to the protection of all of us.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much.
Sure. Enjoyed it.
Stephen Rapp was the prosecutor in the International Court trial against Rwandan journalists who have been convicted of inciting genocide.
Last weekend, guerrillas ambushed two American military convoys in the Iraqi town of Samarra in one of the bloodiest gunfights since the U.S. invaded Iraq. That much is certain. What's less clear is how many lost their lives that day and who those people were. NPR's Ivan Watson was one of the reporters who arrived at the scene. He got this from Brigadier General Mark Kimmett.
It came under small arms and rocket-propelled grenade fire from multiple directions. The fire was determined to be coming from the windows and roofs of nearby buildings, as well as from alleyways and from nearby vehicles.
And this from Samarra resident Abdul Hamid Samarai.
Maybe one or two or five or ten men attack him. But the big people in the street, in the house, in the cities, not have fire gun.
The military is sticking by its assertion that 54 enemy insurgents and no civilians were killed. But local hospital officials can account for only 8 deaths, among them civilians. For the past year and a half, University of Michigan professor Juan Cole has been tracking developments in Iraq on his weblog, juancole.com. He gets his information from Middle Eastern as well as Western media. He also has contacts in military intelligence. Cole was less surprised by the disparity in the body counts than he was by the fact that the Pentagon released such a precise number in the first place, something it hasn't done since the Vietnam War.
It's quite odd, actually, that they did that, because they have resisted counting enemy dead all through recent wars. There's no official U.S. count for enemy dead in the Gulf War, in the Afghanistan War, or in the Iraq War as it was fought in March and April.
It's the reliance on enemy death tolls that seems to echo back to Vietnam. At the time, it was used to foster the impression that the war was progressing better than it actually was. Do you think that the same political calculus is beginning to emerge now in Iraq?
I don't think it actually was initially, at least, a political maneuver, in the sense that these reports of guerrillas killed seem to have come from pretty low down, from the actual soldiers who did the fighting, rather than having been issued initially from General Sanchez. It could have turned into that, possibly. Once they began sticking to their guns, then that seems to have more of a public relations tinge to it.
Well, it's easy to jump to the conclusion that the best antidote for official military reports about events on the ground in Iraq would be eyewitness accounts from people who are actually there. But you have to wonder if it's really a better way to get at the truth. Recent media coverage of the deaths of two American soldiers in Iraq depended heavily on eyewitness accounts that the soldiers' throats had been cut, and that turned out not to be true.
No, but it does appear to be the case that the soldiers had been shot in the neck. So you could easily imagine why the eyewitnesses drew that conclusion. And anybody who deals with eyewitnesses, whether it's police or historians, knows that eyewitnesses are often unreliable. In the case of something like Samarra, I think it's just going to remain very murky.
What do you think that news organizations could do or should do to give us a more accurate picture of what's happening on the ground?
Well, I think they should be trying to draw from a wider range of sources. I remember recently seeing a Western television reporter being interviewed who was based in Baghdad, and he was asked, you know, what's the situation like now in Baghdad? What's the security situation like? And he said, well, for Iraqis, it's good, it's fine, but we Westerners are increasingly being seen as soft targets, so we're in great danger. And that simply was not true. Iraqis are being carjacked and kidnapped and assassinated all the time in Baghdad. That's a very high murder rate. And this person doesn't seem to have known this. And I'm quite sure he didn't speak Arabic and he wasn't in contact with local people who could have told him what the real situation was. He was, in a way, you know, embedded in Western journalism.
So it's possible to be in Baghdad and still live in a bubble?
Oh, yes. I think that a large number of Americans in Baghdad are in a bubble. I think the Coalition Provisional Authority, on the whole and by and large, is itself in a bubble. So I think that it's really important to have Arabists on the team, not just people picked up from the street to do shoddy translation, but bilingual journalists.
Do you think that most Americans would be surprised if they read the same sorts of sources you've been reading on the war in Iraq?
Yes, I think that it's not generally understood by most Americans the degree to which the mood of the country is depressed. No Iraqis like the idea of being occupied because, after all, what modern Iraq is a struggle against British occupation. And all of them have had that drilled into them by the education system. But as a matter of practical reality, they know very well if the Americans just disappeared tomorrow that the country would fall into chaos. So they don't want to be occupied, but they do want to be occupied. It is a very ambiguous situation.
Well, I guess that's my last question then. Do you know what's going on? Is it truly an impossible thing to get from so many miles away? And can you even get it if you're standing in the middle of it?
No, I don't think it's possible really to know what's going on at the moment. I think because of the lack of security, you don't have the ability really to roam freely, even for the reporters that are on the ground. And people see different things. So I think that the situation is inherently subjective, and that's why it is so controversial. I don't pretend to have a complete handle on it. All that I can do is to attempt to report information that seems significant and to try to give it some context, and then I'll let others decide how valuable it is.
Well, you're a historian. You're used to being patient.
Yes, that's right. There's a joke that an Oxford don was approached by a graduate student about a PhD dissertation on the Spanish Armada in the 1500s, and the don said, "No, passion still raged too greatly about that. It's better to choose a more distant subject."
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Juan Cole is a professor of Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He posts his daily ruminations on the war in Iraq on his weblog, juancole.com.
Coming up, image politics on Turkey Day and media Weight Watchers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. More than a week has passed since the president's Thanksgiving trip to Baghdad, but the debate rages on as to whether the press and the American people were inappropriately misled by the White House. I say inappropriately because from the beginning, deception was part of the official plan. While reporters in Texas unwittingly filed bogus dispatches about holiday preparations, Air Force One was stealthily landing in Baghdad with a few reporters on board. A number of observers see it as yet another taxpayer-subsidized PR stunt by President Bush and have criticized the complicity of those few reporters. GOP strategist Mary Madeline, on the other hand, has defended the president's jaunt, telling The Washington Post that it, quote, captured something about the president that people know is true, that he really cares about the soldiers and gets emotional when he sees them. Jay Rosen chairs the journalism program at New York University. He wrote on his blog that the all-too-familiar terms of this debate are not up to the task of truly deconstructing Bush's political maneuver.
Shrewd, unethical, fake, manipulative, honest, real, those are the terms of the debate so far.
So what about the president's trip? Was it real, or was it fake, or was it both?
What interested me about it was that it was impossible to decide. When the president landed on the ground in a war zone, he was creating a reality that is very far from any sort of stunt. First of all, it's dangerous. Second of all, it enters into the politics in Iraq. The logic of the trip is to communicate to the troops, not just the 600 in the airport, but the hundreds of thousands involved in the operation, and to the nation, that the president believes in this cause. Now, you can't say that's just a stunt, because it has repercussions in many arenas. But the trip did not exist as an event independent of its reporting, independent of the press.
As a matter of fact, if the press did not agree to keep silent, then the trip would have been canceled.
The press had the power of life and death over this event, which is a very unusual thing. If the press refused to go, it is then in the business of canceling a presidential visit. It would have to report that it did this because it's news that the president wanted to go to Iraq. And the nation would then have to decide whether it was a good thing that journalists vetoed his visit. If, on the other hand, they say, sure, we'll keep it secret, we'll pretend we don't know, then they are co-producers of the event. And journalistic thinking doesn't cover that class either.
This state of affairs, as you've just described it, you've called the modern publicity state, but you say it's not, in fact, a modern phenomenon. So give us the background.
In 1919, the major powers came to Versailles to try and settle the peace treaty at the end of the World War. And there had been gatherings of statesmen and diplomats before to settle wars. What was new was that news of proposals made was sent instantly back to the home countries. And reaction at home was sent immediately back to the negotiations, and the story started to have an effect on the story. Today we take this for granted. Then it was, wow, a new force in the world. We've never really assimilated that the press is a player in politics, because if in America we say the press is a player, we would have to know what it's playing for. And what we prefer to say is no one, nothing. It brings you the world. That's the rock that we're stuck on, but we've been stuck there since 1919.
What happens to journalism when an event can't be separated from the media coverage of them?
I think you're thrown into a kind of a philosophical confusion that is not necessarily a bad thing, because it means you have to look anew at the world and ask yourself, what is in front of my eyes?
Give me an example.
Well, if I went up to a reporter on Air Force One as it flew to Baghdad, and I asked this person, what the hell are you doing here? He or she would most likely say to me, I'm here to cover the president's surprise trip to Baghdad. And the assumption the person would be making is that this trip exists independently of the intention to cover it. But it does not. And a moment of thought would tell even the journalist that. So that's what I mean. Be a little bit more confused about what you're doing in that situation is an advantage, because your clarity is a false clarity.
So what you're saying here is that the president's Thanksgiving trip exists in some sort of middle region between pure image making and an actual real event that exists outside of press coverage, that there is some sort of middle zone where the two things can't be separated that are still worthy of coverage, even though they only exist to be covered.
It's a quintessentially modern problem of ours, because we live in the world where the media are not just representing the world, they take up a powerful position in it. Journalists are political actors. There's no way around that.
But what is a political actor? A political actor isn't one that simply writes political commentary as a journalist.
No. What I mean by a political actor is what you do makes a difference in the political world. Peter Arnett goes to Baghdad and sits with the Iraqi media. He didn't know how to think politically about what he was doing. And so there are consequences to not being able to see yourself as a political actor. You are in some ways creating the public world. Most of us know this. We know it intuitively. We just don't know how to describe it, debate it, accept it, deal with it.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Brooke, my pleasure. You even taught me something.
Jay Rosen is a press critic and writer who is currently the chair of NYU's journalism program. You can read his reflections about media and democracy on his blog, Press Think, accessible from NYU's website.
The role of reporter as political actor was played out explicitly last month in Georgia, when the independent media there found themselves firmly behind the ouster of Eduard Shevardnadze. The results of parliamentary elections favoring Shevardnadze's party stunned thousands of voters who were ready to see him out of a job, blaming him for massive unemployment, poverty, and corruption. Widespread vote rigging was suspected, and there followed 3 weeks of outrage from the political opposition and the public. Finally, on November 23rd, the president tendered his resignation. The resolutely independent elements of Georgia's media kept up a steady drumbeat of support for the opposition throughout, and commentators are now saying that without those voices, the overthrow may never have happened. Thomas DeWall is the Caucasus editor for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and author of Black Garden, Armenia and Azerbaijan Through Peace and War. He's just returned from Georgia and joins us now from his home in London. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
Let's begin with the central oddity of this story, an apparently rigged election and a robust free press. It's like, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, I think this is a classic example of a little democracy is a dangerous thing. Shevardnadze was, one of the more democratic of the leaders of the former Soviet states, but not very democratic. He, after all, was the Communist Party boss of Georgia way back from 1972. And yes, he did try and rig the elections, although by the standards of other elections in the region, it wasn't that spectacular. And yes, he has tolerated an opposition media, although it has to be said the main television station, Rustavi 2, which has been the opposition's mouthpiece during this whole crisis, he did try and close it down, and the people resisted. They rallied in front of the television headquarters, and Shevardnadze backed down. That was 2 years ago. And now, in retrospect, that looks to have been a very significant event.
Well, let's discuss Rustavi 2, which, along with the independent newspaper 24 Hours, seems to have been pivotal in the president's overthrow.
We're talking about a very professional channel. They've had a very strong focus on corruption. They've got their own version of 60 Minutes. They've also got a political cartoon show, which has satirized the government over all this time. And during this whole crisis, they were running live reports from the street demonstrations, which obviously showed people in the rest of Georgia what was going on in the capital, the scale of opposition. And also they were regularly broadcasting alternative results because there were organizations monitoring these elections, and Rustavi too was giving them a voice.
Now, as the what has been called Rose's Revolution was underway, the state TV was broadcasting a documentary about penguins. What do you suppose will happen now that the Democrats are in power? Will they flip-flop?
Well, of course, the cynics are saying that that's exactly what's happening, that Rustavi 2 is now looking more and more like state TV. The new lot are coming in. They're appointing their friends and cronies. I'm sure there's some of that going on, but I'm a bit more optimistic than that. I think we're also seeing in Georgia a younger generation taking charge, people who've more likely to have studied in the West than in Moscow, people who've got a more liberal outlook in general. Another interesting feature of this whole thing is the part played by George Soros and his Open Society Institute. They very much backed the opposition. They funded Rustavi 2 and 24 Hours. And I don't think Mr. Soros would look kindly at his money being spent on setting up just an alternative state channel.
In fact, in your interview with Shevardnadze about a week after his fall, he blamed non-governmental organizations, which he believed had agitated for the Roses Revolution. Do you think that, in effect, George Soros overthrew the Shevardnadze regime?
Well, certainly Mr. Shevardnadze seems to think so. He didn't mention him by name in the interview with us, but he has mentioned him by name before and called for Soros's offices to be closed down. Obviously, that's a bit simplistic, but there is one other startling fact, which is that Soros paid for members of the Georgian opposition to go to Belgrade earlier this year. And what they were discussing was actually the peaceful overthrow of Milosevic. And Rustavi, too, of course, was broadcasting, meanwhile, a documentary about the peaceful overthrow of Milosevic. So again, Soros' money was funding this kind of activity, which helped the Georgian opposition to copy the Serbian model.
The United States has a checkered history, to say the least, through its CIA of toppling governments in Latin America and the Middle East and elsewhere. And it, in varying degrees, is out of that business, at least through the CIA. But now comes a private, non-governmental organization funded by Soros's billions, also with the announced aim of toppling regimes largely by financing media. Should we be concerned about this? I mean, who's watching the watchdogs?
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. The key difference here, as opposed to the CIA in Iran or Chile or wherever, is that no one got hurt here, that Soros has been funding what you could call pluralistic politics. And I suppose the argument from his side might be that if you don't fund that kind of pluralistic politics, that just drives the opposition underground, which is what you see, for example, in the Central Asian states of the former Soviet Union, places like Uzbekistan. And that just creates violence, and that if you're actually financing a responsible opposition, you're doing the authorities a favor as well.
Well, Thomas, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thomas DeWall is the Caucasus editor for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and author of Black Garden, Armenia and Azerbaijan Through Peace and War.
It's important to remember is a 350-pound person has a tremendous amount of insulation around them, so the effectiveness of those jabs is very minimized, and the officers have to work even harder. Take into consideration the fact that he also has a tremendous amount of natural strength and is much larger than these officers. It's a monumental task. In fact,
when an apparently PCP-addled 350-pound Cincinnati man died while being subdued by police last week, many reading the news accounts focused on the checkered history of the Cincinnati police, but at least one reader was curious about something else. Why the victim's girth figured so prominently in the reporting? USA Today's Detroit Bureau Chief David Kiley wrote to Jim Romanesco's Poynter Institute website to complain about the weight-centric coverage.
My problem with the Wire story was that the headline and the lead both identified him as a 350-pound man, as if that was part of his crime. Neither the headline nor the lead mentioned the fact that he was hopped up on PCP and that that's caused the melee with the police in the first place.
You think this is endemic to journalism?
I do. A lot of reporters refer to a person's weight almost as if to back up or substantiate a crime, an alleged crime, a mental illness. For example, in 2000, police caught a former sailor who was a serial killer. And in most of the stories about that guy, they referred to him as a 300-pound killer. One story said the former sailor was sad as his 300-pound body heaved with tearful confessions. Now, my question is, if he was 180 pounds, wouldn't his body still have been heaving? But would it have been mentioned? Another example that I like is an AP story from December 2002 talks about an aspiring police officer who allegedly injured his baby son while bouncing him on his leg. The man was described as a 300-pound aspiring police officer. His weight is used against him almost like a prior conviction. And one more story that I think rounds out the pattern is a Sarasota Herald Tribune story from March of this year about corrupt police officers. The strongest turncoat, John Mervolian, is a 300-pound hulk who other officers consider a disruptive, dishonest snitch. The other, William Hames, is an alcoholic who quit drinking after holding a gun on a bus driver on a drunken blackout. I mean, here's another case where a guy is being described as a snitch, and they throw in the fact that he weighs 300 pounds. I don't think they would have done that if he'd weighed 190 pounds.
All right, fair enough. But as I look through the examples that you gave me, many of these headlines are about attacks by very heavy men. And the weight is not cited completely out of nowhere. It gets to how menacing the situation was for the police officers who were on hand to deal with it or for the victims of the crime. So are you yourself oversensitive to what are perfectly legitimate invocations of someone's physical specs?
Probably. I weigh just shy of 290 pounds. I used to weigh a lot more. But what bothers me as a reporter, as well as a large man trying to get along in the world, is reinforcing stereotypes in our news copy. Look, people read stories that equate being fat with committing a crime. And these crimes are often sexual or abuse-related, and they make an impression after impression. Well, what's the effect of that when people go to hire a person who's obese? But how about when a jury is evaluating someone's guilt or innocence and how their impressions of fat people might color their thinking on a verdict?
So in this world of political correctness and extreme sensitivity to stigmatizing language and everything that goes with it, how is the sensitivity to obesity slip between the cracks?
I don't know how it has, except that it is, in my opinion, the last refuge of hate in this country. There's something about obese people, about fat people, that people think that they have a license, that it's still socially okay to relegate fat people to some compartment of society. I've seen numerous studies about how fat people find it harder to get employed, how they make less money than thin people in several industries. And look, you know, we see this played out in the movies and in television all the time where fat people are made to look pathetic and stupid. I just have a real problem with it being reinforced in news copy.
All right, David. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Bob, for the time and for allowing me to talk about it.
Coming up, branding the new liberal network and firing up conservative campus newspapers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924 on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Naysayers across the political spectrum take note. The much-discussed and oft-dismissed liberal radio network may soon be a reality. Central Air Network and its parent company, Progress Media, are now poised to purchase a bunch of radio stations in major markets around the country, and they're currently in talks with lefty celebrities Al Franken and Janine Garofalo. The plan is to launch by spring 2004 and join the election fray. Mark Walsh is CEO of both Central Air and Progress Media, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
First of all, is this a sure thing? How many stations are you planning to have in your network, and have you bought any of them yet?
Well, as you know, nothing in life is a sure thing, and we have not physically completed the transaction for the purchase of our first five stations, but we have signed a short-form agreement that is indicative of our seller's interest and ours as a purchaser. So we're very encouraged about our ability to get our voice out early in 2004.
Of course, the response from the right has been that there are already a bunch of liberal networks on the air, PBS, CBS, CNN, NPR. You get the idea.
I do.
So how will your network sound different from what's already out there?
Well, I think one of the things we're focusing on early on is to be funny.
We've read that you've hired founder of The Daily Show, Liz Winstead, to head up your entertainment programming. Is The Daily Show your model for at least some of the liberal entertainment you want to provide?
It's a darn good model. I'm a Jon Stewart junkie. His ability to, with an arch of the eyebrow, a slight curl of the lip, a wry sentence or phrase, to make a comment on the foibles of today's political scene, left or right, is I'm in envy of that.
Traveling under extreme secrecy, President Bush paid a surprise visit to U.S. soldiers in Iraq on Thanksgiving Day for a holiday dinner that boosted morale. Bush's appearance was a complete surprise to the troops, and Iraq's civil administrator Paul Bremer and commanding general Ricardo Sanchez played it for all it was worth.
Let's see if we got anybody more senior here who can read the president's Thanksgiving speech. Is there anybody back there who's more senior than us?
That's funny stuff.
A lot of Democrats don't have a sense of humor. We find ourselves often so upset, or as the right would like to label us, you know, enraged, this liberal rage, which I think is also a fantasy, but very upset about what we see. And our sense of humor often suffers from that upsettedness. And one of our goals is to not reflect the pure upset element that is going on in the Democratic Party or the progressive voice in America, but to be more of a central voice that says, hey, both sides have their viewpoints that are laughable, so let's not go to the edges of the bell curve, so to speak. Let's be decidedly able to have a debate on our shows between left and right and a discussion that is entertaining and comedic. The Republicans have been dramatically, stupendously, galactically successful at galvanizing opinion bluntly around the rage that President Clinton aroused in them. I'm a brand guy. I understand brands. And I would argue the Democratic Party has lost its brand vitality, while the Republican Party has generated true brand vitality. People buy brands. When we enter a voting booth and pull that curtain, we are pulling a lever for a brand.
So what are the characteristics of the liberal brand that you hope to establish with your network?
Well, there are two answers to that. One is to return to the traditional characteristics of the liberal brand that were so successful in the 60s, 70s, part of the 80s, and obviously under President Clinton as he expanded the brand. And those represent financial viability, a nation that is financially strong. Yes, security here at home and abroad, although we are often painted as a party that cares less about security. In fact, I would argue the exact reverse, that the Democratic Party has been.
I want you to go a little more high concept with me here,
okay,
Mark. When we're talking about a brand, you're talking about a kind of new frontier, Kennedy-esque, mixed with the Grateful Dead kind of thing? Or what exactly are you talking about?
Well, now, that's funny that you would say that, because you're reflecting the nuggetization, I call it, of very, very high concepts by this White House.
Well, at least I'm not upsetitizing about it. No, the point of the matter here is that you do know, though, whenever you turn on the radio, you can expect a particular sound from a particular network, whether it's public radio, those sonorous tones, or the more overheated, passionate tones of talk radio or so forth. You know pretty much what you're going to get. And so when we talk about branding, what's the tone that you have in mind for the liberal radio network?
Well, our tone is comedy and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to ask for a couple of words, with information as a kicker. So the goal is to entertain, laugh, and learn.
If they spread too wide, they really imitate The Daily Show and go after a group that's too broad, my prediction is that it's all going to fizzle out.
Thomas DeZengotita says Progress Media's Mark Walsh has the wrong strategy. Don't pitch to the center. Fill the airwaves with an array of niche programs for gays, blacks, feminists, anti-globalists, and so on. Zengotita lays all this out in November's Harper's Magazine and even pitches a show for a particular niche.
So I've picked a niche that I think is a significant tipping point niche with enormous leverage in the culture as a whole, thinking long term. And that's the niche of people from 19 to 30 They're really well educated. They know who Foucault is. They've read Derrida. They've read some Nietzsche. These same people are as immersed in, you know, websites that talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer or the X-Men and what their superpowers stand for. Young people who are, by and large, alienated from politics, too ironic, too fragmented into their various identity groups, too hip to really care about a general progressive resurgence in this country.
So who would host the show? Al Franken?
No, you know, Al Franken is a wonderful guy. He's doing a fantastic job with the mean, cruel attack comedy that would be a big part of the show I'm recommending. But I don't think he's young enough. I don't think he's intellectual enough to appeal to the niche I'm talking about. There's two people involved in the show, you know, the sort of host and the second banana. I understand that's what the term as they use. And I'm picturing a young guy, maybe 30. He's been to significant graduate school. He might be ABD.
All but dissertation,
right. And he's funny, but like a lot of people who answer that general profile, he's not that strong on the facts. So he's got this second banana person with him. He or she is a fact person, not only in terms of what they kind of are able to store as an individual, but they're online. They've got a laptop with them. They've got directories filled with places and references and so on. And this is a person who can bring facts smoothly into a serious political conversation as it unfolds between the host and the guest.
You call that person a quack.
Person who actually knows stuff. The joke in that being that the people in the niche I've just described, they have a dirty little hidden secret, most of them, that even though they went to the best Ivy League schools in the country, they don't actually know that much, particularly in the area of history and economics.
What would the regular segments on the program be?
You got a regular segment that involves correcting misinformation that you happen to broadcast in a previous show. That's very important. It just demonstrates that you're really serious about what the facts are. You've got segments where you might bring in a serious intellectual to talk about, you know, how everything's a simulation, somebody like Frederick Jameson. But at the same time that you've got Frederick Jameson in there, who's this huge professor that all these people in my niche have read a little of or heard of, you've got the director of The Matrix or the guy who wrote the script for The Matrix, and they're on there together. And then maybe the host takes a phone call from someone who's actually been on a reality show, who talks about what it's like to be on a reality show. And the host makes that conversation works.
I got to tell you, this just doesn't sound funny.
That part's not funny. You've got regular parodies. There's a regular segment called the O'Malley Fixture, okay? And you've got a good O'Reilly imitator, okay? And then I've got an interview written out where he interviews this nun from Africa and just won't let her talk. And I've got Hanratty and Caves, got them parodied.
As opposed to Hannity and Combs.
Right.
And I honestly think that this demographic that you think is so big is actually quite tiny.
I don't think it's tiny. I think it's 500,000. That's in cable land these days. That's a group.
Well, I think about Rush Limbaugh. How he managed to develop such a broad constituency is because he tapped into something that was quite universal, a general feeling among middle-aged white men that they were being screwed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, can that be duplicated by a network for the left?
The good thing about this moment in our history and the reason we've got these people with serious commitments and money involved in setting up liberal outlets now is because there is a feeling that we're being screwed since Bush got, where there's a real outrage about the fraud of the Bush administration. But this has to go further. You can learn from what the right wing did, but you can't imitate them. The people who say you can't have left-wing versions of the right-wing talk shows because left-wing views are so complicated compared to this kind of spewing anger that the right can do, there's a certain amount of truth to that. A rainbow's not a unified movement. It's just not. We lost all the kids because it's a big lie. And the kids know it. And when they listen to sort of normal kind of lefty progressive panels of people getting up there, everyone taking his turn, saying his thing, and then there's some little thing about this that this is unified, it's just not.
And so the cure for the apoliticization
is truth.
Okay.
And in two senses. It's truth in terms of self-criticism on the left, people really coming to terms with the fact that we've lost our rudder. We have no sense of who we are, no sense of direction. And it's truth in the sense of there is such a thing as truth.
Okay. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Thomas DeZengotita teaches at New York University's Draper Program. His article, Turn On, Tune In, appeared in the November issue of Harper's.
Where can a conservative, libertarian, free market traditionalist college student find like-minded media? There's always Fox News, but as it turns out, there are other conservative outposts as well. Since 1979, the Leadership Institute, an Arlington, Virginia-based think tank, has seen 30,000 students walk through its doors and emerge political operatives. Hosting dozens of seminars, classes, and internships, the Leadership Institute is the Walmart of conservative thought, offering lessons in everything from candidate development to television techniques to starting college newspapers. It's the new alternative press, and it ain't what it used to be. On the Media, Sarah Lemanchik went to the front lines.
A lot of times conservatives complain about the media, and we always stress at the Leadership Institute, conservatives should not complain about the media. Conservatives should be the media.
For the past decade, the Leadership Institute has been putting on a traveling roadshow of conservative journalism, encouraging conservative students to take a more active role in campus politics. Josh Mercer is the current director of student publications.
We don't endorse any specific candidate for office. We don't wear any politicians' pins on our suits. We just want people to think a little bit more critically about issues from a traditional family values and free market approach.
What they do is start college newspapers. And if Josh Mercer were the Lone Ranger, then Owen Brennan Rounds would be Tonto. A one-time speechwriter for former New York City Mayor Giuliani, Owen gallops alongside Josh from college to college.
Newspapers have sort of a soul. They have a mission statement. They have a purpose. They have a point of view. They're very different from a daily paper that just seeks to sort of be, quote, objective.
For Owen, objectivity is a delusion of the complacent, narcissistic, liberal press.
They don't teach this at journalism schools. They don't teach people to go out and be a pit bull reporter anymore. They teach journalists, you know, it's more of a trade school now where the pinnacle achievement is going out and writing a story about why Aunt B has the finest pie stand in all of Washington County. You know, we want to be more of a cavalry.
Riding into battle are students like Chris Pryor, editor-in-chief of The Fountainhead, an ally-supported paper out of the University of Oklahoma. He remembers his introduction as a freshman to the staff of The Fountainhead.
They had us go around the room and introduce each other and ask what books we would like to see burned. And yeah, that seems real, and it is real. But that's just kind of the introduction I got to these guys. They're way out there, and they're certainly blood and guts conservatives, which is something you don't see very often on campus.
They impressed Chris enough to make him want to write for the paper, and later to spend the summer as an intern at the Leadership Institute, a place where he picked up some jargon and a belief in the allies' outsider tactics.
We are five or six guys, and sometimes girls, putting together a newspaper in my place. It's a different kind of environment. The LI even has a name for them. I think they call them 3AMers. People who stay up way late and do these kind of covert type things. That's the real attitude that you get with these people. These are people who want to go out there and they have something in mind that they want to defeat.
The ranks of the Leadership Institute talk a lot about the war of ideas. Chris and other LI alum are waging a war against what they consider to be the hegemony of left-leaning institutions. Josh Mercer remembers the moment he knew he had to fight. It was at a campus lecture, listening to a conservative speaker discuss the controversial murder case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Most of the people that are standing up and screaming and yelling were not actually college students themselves. They were local community activists, people who work, I presume, full-time to try to convince students to become socialists. And I thought, well, you know, it's about time that we had more people dedicated to the cause of freedom and introducing young college conservatives to a different perspective.
Perspectives he believes are not being addressed in the established campus papers. The Fountainhead editor-in-chief, Chris Pryor.
When we take on a professor for being extremely feminist, I mean, to the point of ludicrousness, students in that classroom won't have the fear of thinking, you know, if I speak up against this professor, I'll get an F in this class because look at the Fountainhead. They're doing it too. Geez, they put her picture next to a mummy. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, we can do now.
Journalists are always going to have a perspective that they're writing from.
Again, former Giuliani speechwriter Owen Brennan Rounds.
If they work for a news organization where that perspective is understood, that makes them more effective at communicating their message.
Allison Kasick is the editor of The Counterweight from Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. In the 3 years since its founding, The Counterweight has gone from a small newsletter to a 20-page paper with a full-color cover.
We've really been fighting the speech code at Bucknell. That was an issue that really went unnoticed until we decided to write about it in The Counterweight.
The paper considers campus rules against racially or sexually derisive language to be a violation of free speech.
that's kind of the strategy when you're fighting these things, is that the administration can't justify in the public eye what they kind of do in private. What we've been doing is, ever since that we kind of brought this issue into the limelight, we've printed the speech code in every single issue of The Counterweight, and we'll continue to do that until the speech code doesn't exist anymore.
To ensure the continued existence of The Counterweight and other conservative papers, the Leadership Institute employs field reps on call for any kind of neocon, libertarian, free market crisis the student papers might have. And the papers are thriving. The California Patriot was started nearly 4 years ago with the Allies' help. And even before Arnold Schwarzenegger, it ignited enough conservative sparks to start three new papers in California. And according to Owen, that's only the beginning.
The students who are putting these publications together today have much more in common with sort of the pamphleteers of the revolution. It's not quite Tea Party-esque, but, you know, these are the first bubblings of revolution on campus.
The Leadership Institute has helped start over 80 papers so far, leaving, according to their calculations, about 3,000 campus news racks ripe for occupation. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.